Chapter 3. The night was as black as only Hanko's thick curtains of storm cloud could make it. Wind howled around the ice boulders, creating strange antagonistic harmonics, while overhead occasional forks of lightning turned the tragic landscape into a monochrome silhouette. Right at the edge of the Asiatic glacier, a flare of tangerine light burst into existence, creating an eerie aural blaze around the top of the titanic cliff. It vanished in an instant. The ice trembled in reaction. After a while, the spray of tangerine light gushed up again, brighter this time. Larger ice fragments jumped and juddered at the vibrations hammering through the surface. A pause filled by the eternal yowl of the blizzard. The light appeared once more. This time splinters of ice erupted from the top of the cliff, swirling away into the mile-high abyss. A hand wearing a thick grey gauntlet crept up and patted the surface, scrabbling for a firm purchase. Aaron heaved himself up and rolled onto the top of the glacier. After a moment he clambered to his feet. He swept the surrounding area with his bionic field scan function, seeking traces of the ground crawler. The trail it had taken was plain enough, retracing its original route through the boulder field. He started to run after it. He was very, very angry. The Clipsby Cafe on Dariad Avenue served exactly the kind of breakfast Oscar loved. Industrial strength coffee, bacon baguettes, and almond croissants with a dip pot of agal syrup. Despite the three of them wearing the Alesalin police uniform, the owner served them readily enough. The only other customers were also Alesalin troopers grabbing a late breakfast between alerts. This morning should have been so different. Everyone in the city had stayed up, accessing Justine's heroic dash for the void. Unisphere and Gaiafield alike were enraptured by the appearance of the second dreamer. Rumor and speculation were currently the foremost indulgence of billions. Yet here in Colwyn the atmosphere of wonder had been ripped to pieces by the welcome team's raid. There had been a lot of people in the park outside the apartment block. They'd reacted predictably enough to such a brash act, taunting the paramilitary troops on the cordon. It was touch and go if a full riot would erupt. As a result, the city seemed even more paralyzed than yesterday. Very few citizens were going into work. They were either too fearful of getting caught up in disturbances, or they were heading out to join the crowd in Bodant and other hotspots, where they might get lucky and give some hapless foreign trooper a good kicking. Either way, not much was open in the center of town. Oscar accepted another refill from the waitress, smiling in gratitude. The cafe owner might have cajoled her to serve him, but she certainly didn't have to smile back as she was pouring. "So what now?" he asked Amancio as the woman stomped off and the privacy shield shimmered on around their table. "Information is the key, as always," Amancio replied, trying not to frown at the food piled up in front of Oscar. For himself he'd ordered a smoked gruslet and cream cheese sandwich to go with his green tea. "We know without any doubt that the second dreamer was in that apartment block, which means either the welcome team have him, and Major Honolar will find that out for sure in the next 6 hours, or he escaped before we got there."
"We were there fast," Beccia said. "I don't think I could have got out, not without a lot of fuss."
"This man is smart," Amancio said. Using Denal's apartment was a superb misdirection.
"But how could he have got out?" Oscar asked. "They would have seen any capsule lifting from the apartments."
"Stealth?" Beccia suggested. She wrinkled her nose in dissatisfaction.
"But if he's got a stealth capsule, why would he actually commune with the Gaiafield from Denal's apartment? That doesn't make any sense."
"The only practical escape route would be some kind of tunnel not on the city plans," Amancio said, "and the apartments are being refurbished by a whole load of different developers. That would give him plenty of scope for such an activity."
"That presupposes he knew he'd need an escape tunnel," Oscar said. "How would he know Ethan was going to annex the whole planet and flood the city with paramilitaries?"
"Connections in Living Dream," Beccia said with a baffled tone. She shook her head. "That doesn't make any sense either. If you have those kinds of connections, why go on the lam like this?"
"You don't suppose this is Inigo, do you?" Oscar suggested.
Amancio pulled a breath through clenched teeth,
I'd hate to rule it out. But this simply isn't Inigo's way of doing things. He doesn't need to sneak around. For a start, his word alone is the only thing which could stop Ethan's insane pilgrimage.
Not so insane, Beckia muttered, and not so easily stopped. Not anymore. The whole of the Greater Commonwealth just watched Justine's ship go through the barrier. The second dreamer can get the pilgrimage inside. That's a phenomenal boost to Living Dream's credibility.
It also secures Ethan's leadership, Timancio said. Even if Inigo did turn up now, he might not have the authority to pull it off.
Wouldn't be the first time a religion outgrows its messiah, Oscar said.
No, indeed. So, we're left with the same problem everyone else has, finding this extremely slippery second dreamer.
I don't believe in secret tunnels, Oscar said.
He drank some of his coffee, enjoying the bitter liquid burning its way down his throat. It had been a long time since he'd got some sleep.
There's something about this which isn't right.
Care to elaborate?
I can't, unfortunately. I'm just not convinced that the second dreamer is some kind of super-smart covert operative. Living Dream had to out him in the first place. Now he's communing with a Sky Lord, which is something Inigo never managed. That doesn't come over as someone who's thought out the consequences of their actions.
He managed to elude us, Timancio said reasonably. That takes a lot of talent and thought.
Does it? No offense, but we were rushed, as was the welcome team.
The welcome team has spent months training for this. Oscar gave the bottom of his coffee mug a miserable glance.
I don't know. I just don't get what his long plan is. Everything he's done says to me that he's reacting to events, not controlling them. What we have is a normal bloke caught up in monstrous events and doing his best to keep afloat.
He could be getting help from some faction, Beckia said.
From what my source tells me, he hasn't, Oscar said. But we can't rule it out.
Okay, enough, Timancio said. It's pointless to argue this. Once we find him, we can ask him. In the meantime, we have ourselves the mother of all shadow operations here. He opened a secure link to Leatris. Have you located Araminta for me yet?
No. Sorry, boss. She's disconnected her U-Shadow from the Unisphere. Hardly surprising after the apartment raid. I've got monitor programs loaded into every node in the city, ready for when she comes back online. Interestingly, so do a number of other people. And I'm also watching her credit account, but until she comes back out of the Stone Age, she's invisible to me.
All right. What about her history? Anything there to clue us in? Boyfriend? Girlfriend? Someone she'll turn to?
She's an interesting girl. Recently divorced.
Husband's location?
On Oak Tier and migrating inwards.
Aussie?
Okay. Give me something in the city, even if it's just which salon she uses.
She doesn't have a regular salon.
Leatris!
Don't panic, I've got some nuggets for you. And trust me, this took some serious reference matching on her data patterns.
Go.
Her cousin, who handled the divorce, is Cressida, a very senior partner in the best law firm in town, extremely well connected locally. And incidentally, she and a whole group of friends are just about to mug Ethan. Get this, they've hired a passenger ship from Dumbervand Lines, one with full diplomatic status to evacuate themselves.
Really?
Timancio's mind popped a burst of mischievous delight into the Gaia field.
Relevant?
Oscar asked. The Dunbarvan family is a major faraway political force. God help Living Dream if they try and interfere with their ship's flight schedule. Forget diplomats squabbling in the Senate. The original Dunbarvan patriarch was a Starflyer war hero, which gives his descendants a certain kind of very stubborn mindset. They really would consider dispatching a warship into Vyosha orbit to enforce their right of passage. Smart lady, this Cressida.
One of the tickets she booked is for Araminta, Leatris told them. She's also trying to find an off-world investment consortium to buy Araminta's apartment development project.
Then we watch Cressida.
Already set up. I've got more scrutineers and monitors surrounding her than Living Dream have followers.
Excellent. Until Araminta makes contact with Cressida, we concentrate on our original objective, riding the welcome team's data wave. Anything from Cheridan?
No, he's gone down to the docks with Mareble to try and get Denal out of Major Honolar's clutches,
Once he's done that, we'll have us a very strong ally among the Confluence Nest technicians. It might have been the lack of sleep this morning, or the really very strong coffee numbing his synapses, but Oscar was slow mulling over their discussion. Why is she hiding? The welcome team raid was scary, sure, but that wouldn't make her do this, unless she was in the apartment block. And if she was, there. Araminta also spent a weekend with Lycan, Leatris said.
No shit, Timancio said.
I'm not sure it's significant. Lycan normally works his way through 2 or 3 women a week in addition to his harem, and Araminta seems to have been playing the field since her divorce.
I used to work for Nigel Sheldon, Oscar said. I even met him a couple of times when Wilson and I were building up the Navy. He'd be horrified about this modern ideology that's hijacked his name.
And the relevance is? An exasperated Timancio asked. Oscar gave him an apologetic shrug.
Sorry. Just thinking.
Is she seeing anyone special? Timancio asked Leatris. Not that I've found yet. I'm running traffic analysis on her capsule, but it's got to be slow and discreet. There are another 3 similar investigations that I spotted, and that's in addition to Living Dream, which is now officially interested in her. But the local police have found her trike. It was parked at the Tala Mall yesterday afternoon, her last confirmed sighting. Major Honolar has ordered the records from every city sensor to be shoved through visual recognition filters to work out where she went. That should keep them busy for the rest of the day.
Thanks, Leatris.
She has to be able to tell us something, Bekia said. She had to be badly frightened to vanish like this. I guess that's what Major Honolar does to people.
Agreed.
Oscar grinned at the 2 of them. Bekia had said it without even realizing, but then it would take someone with his background to make that particular connection. If anyone in the Commonwealth knew all about vanishing and staying vanished, it was Oscar Munro, which just left motivation. Timancio caught the grin and frowned.
What?
Don't you get it?
Oscar was delighted with himself.
Well, how about that? The old relic has still got it.
Get what? Bekia said.
I spent decades living a lie, hiding my actual self from everyone I knew and loved and worked with. It's actually a lot easier than you'd think. So I guess it takes one to know one.
Timancio's square jaw dropped.
Oh, great, Ozzy. You think?
I think it's highly likely.
Bekia hunched forwards, giving Oscar an astonished look.
She's the second dreamer.
Give me a better candidate.
Bloody hell.
It won't take Honolar long to work it out.
And when he does, she'll be in deep shit, Timancio said urgently. No local girl will be able to stay ahead of the welcome team.
She's done pretty well so far, Oscar protested.
You can only get so far on luck, and she's used up her quota. We need to supply some help. Leatris, start laying a false data trail for the good major. Give me 10 minutes. I'll have him running all over town.
She was there, wasn't she?
Bekia said with growing admiration. Somehow, in the apartment when we were looking.
Unless she spent last month digging a tunnel, yes, Oscar said.
Timancio gave him a certain look.
It's still cordoned off. Let's go.
Their borrowed capsule was parked on the pad outside. Oscar raced past the waitress, feeling only mildly guilty for not leaving a tip. It took Araminta 2 cups of tea and 1/2 the packet of biscuits to work up enough nerve to shove the crate to one side and open the door a fraction. There was no one in the vestibule. No sound from anywhere inside the building, as far as she could tell. Outside, it was different. The angry shouting was loud. There were thuds as lumps of stone and concrete landed around the paramilitary troops. Glass was being smashed constantly. The distinct humming of capsules ebbed and flowed. She strapped on her tool belt, shrugged into a thick fleece jacket to cover it, and headed for the stairwell. The cordon included a shield reinforcing the broad garage door, which buzzed as if a high-voltage current was running through it. In the dim lighting which pervaded the ramp, Araminta could just see a dull sparkle shimmering off the door's surface. There was no way she could get out. It would take a good quantity of enhanced explosives to break through. She turned and headed to the other side of the garage, which contained the utility's support area. It was dark inside the first room. Still reluctant to use any power, she fished a torch out of her belt and walked between two rows of big tanks. At the far end was a smaller door into the waste handling room. She'd only been in here a couple of times before, to make sure the interface with her new units was compatible. Bulky, quite primitive-looking machinery filled most of the space, big metal spheres with lots of piping snaking about between them. Araminta wiggled between a couple of water sanitizer cisterns. Behind them, the sidewall was a sheer surface of reinforced enzyme-bonded concrete. Just above her head was a rectangular hole where 6 feed pipes went outside to connect with the main civic water supply. The gap between the top of the pipes and the edge of the concrete was about 0.5 meters. She clambered up one of the sanitizer cisterns, wincing every time she gripped a hot pipe by mistake. That put her level with the hole. A metal grid covered the far end. Grass and soil was pressed up against it. Gritting her teeth in determination, she dropped her thick fleece and wormed her head and shoulders into the hole. She still had to stretch to apply the power socket against the grill's locking bolts. They were stiff from disuse, and she was scared of making too much noise with the power socket. But after several minutes cursing and blinking sweat from her eyes, the grill came loose. Then it took another 5 minutes, pushing and shoving before the grass and soil gave way. The tool belt had to be discarded before she could claw her way through the uncomfortably claustrophobic gap. Araminta crawled out onto the narrow strip of grass between the apartment wall and the wooden fence. Blouse torn on snags, skin scratched and bleeding, trouser knees muddy, hair a tangled mess, hot, flushed, and sweaty. She glared back at the little hole. I can't have put on that much weight. The noise of the crowd was a lot louder. Amplified voices were constantly warning them to back off. A capsule slid over the band of sky above her. She quickly pulled her tool belt out of the hole and started using the screwdriver on the fence boards. With 3 of them unfastened, she could slip through the triangular opening and into an almost identical strip of ground on the other side. The neighboring building was a combination of retail and office units, half of which were unoccupied and available for a low rent. She crept along the side of the building to the waste casket bay at the back. The gates beyond opened onto a thin alley of badly cracked concrete. Someone had left an old jacket on the ledge running along the bay. She pulled it on over her torn blouse and slung the tool belt over her shoulder. Then, taking a breath, she sauntered out into the alley. 2 of Alezalin's armor-suited paramilitaries were standing on cordon duty outside the back gate to the apartment block. Araminta ignored them and walked off down the alley. Every second she expected a challenge, but it never came. After 20 meters she made a sharp left turn down another alley, taking her out of their view. Then she just kept walking. After forever, he strode through a white jungle. Trees of translucent crystal towered above him, refracting a soft shimmer of pure sunlight, sprouting long white leaves. The undergrowth was thick, creepers and bushes mangled into dense tangles of silver hues that were impossible to push through. White clouds scudded overhead. A cloying mist wove long swirling streamers round the shiny tree trunks, reducing visibility. White birds darted about, triangles of feathers fluttering fast. White rodents scampered round his booted feet. His boots were clotted with white mud from the steaming loam. I know it's difficult, said the voice behind the trees, but you have to choose. He longed for color, darkness even, but all the jungle offered was faint shadows. Shapes were starting to blur together, losing cohesion. The blazing universe was absorbing him. When he lifted up his hands, they were hard to see, white on white. Just looking at them was dizzying. You can lose yourself. Lose what is. Lose what you have done. Your life will never have existed. Sometimes I wish I could offer that to myself. Then the enemy started to close in. He saw them all around, little flickers of motion darting through the undergrowth. They were waiting for him. He knew it. It was an ambush. He yelled defiance at them. His bionics unleashed a terrible burst of energy. Clumps of undergrowth disintegrated into kinetic maelstroms. He was thrown from side to side by the sharp leaf and stone fragments swatting against him. Vision reduced, but still it was all white. In front, on both sides, above, below, white, white, white. Through it all crept the enemy,
malicious, determined, lethal. He blasted away at them, seeing them burn. Powerful white flame consumed them, sending torrents of white smoke into the sky. Shot after shot was fired into the suffocating uniform whiteness. It began to constrict about him. No matter how violent his energy discharges, they couldn't penetrate it.
"Help me!" he cried out to the voice. "Take me out of this! I choose! I choose! I remember I chose! I wanted not to happen!"
He could no longer tell which way was up, and tumbled through the whiteness. His own screams were loud in his ears as the whiteness slipped and banged against his suit visor. Then he hit something which stopped his headlong rush with a suddenness that knocked the wind from him. There at last was another color. Red sparkles of pain danced across his vision as he drew a desperate breath. He closed his eyes, squeezing the lids shut, then blinking them open. Shards of gray-black rock lay sizzling against the ice, slowly sinking in through the puddles they were creating.
"Shit!"
Aaron groaned gloomily. He forced himself onto all fours, then slowly staggered upright. The whiteout had got to him, providing an insidious outlet for the demons churning around his subconscious.
"What the hell is inside me? What did I try and cast away?"
He shook his head, running a full status check through his bionic systems, and reviewed the routines in his macrocellular clusters as well. Cooler air blew into his helmet, allowing him to take some sobering breaths. Looking around, he saw he'd left the field of ice boulders behind. The wind had dropped, leaving just a few flurries of snow skipping through the air. Steam was pushing up out of a dozen craters where his energy shots had vaporized the ice. He could see the serrated crystalline boulders lining the horizon behind him. Exovision superimposed his route, sketching it with simple lines of glowing orange. The ground crawler had been easy to follow through the field, scraping past boulders to leave crumbled shards on the ground, or where Inigo had simply carved his way through the smaller gaps. Now they were out on the open top of the glacier, it was hard to tell. Aaron trotted away from the area he'd devastated, circling round. There was no indication of the ground crawler at all. The thin dusting of ice shifted continually, completely eradicating any sign of the tracks. As he stood and watched, his own footprints were smeared away behind him almost as soon as he made them. There was no residual heat signature. It had been at least 6 hours since Inigo and Corilin had driven out of the boulder field. On this frozen world, their infrared traces would have vanished within 20 minutes. He had absolutely no way of telling which way they'd gone. Fuck it. There were no options left. His inertial guidance mapped a route back to Jujani, via the Olhava camp, the only route he was sure didn't have glacier cliffs or other obstacles. Not that he'd ever get there before the planet imploded, he reflected, but if any rescue attempt was going to happen, that would be where the starship landed. It was all he had left. Simply lying down and waiting for the end wasn't him. Whoever me is. He started to run again, his bionic energy currents reconfigured to scream a distress signal into the eternal storm. The local star's azure spectrum shone brightly on the hull of the Melanie's Redemption as it dropped out of hyperspace 500 kilometers above Oricum. Troblum accessed the external sensors, seeing a planet that was essentially the same as every human-settled world in the Greater Commonwealth. Blue ocean swathed in puffy white cloud, brown landmasses with a fuzz of green. Its electromagnetic emissions were a lot lower than a central world, reflecting the relatively small population of advancers and naturals. The kind of world that provided an ideal, quiet life. Knowing what he did about Oscar Monroe, Troblum wasn't at all surprised that the old war hero had chosen this place to settle. He ordered the starship smart core to enter the atmosphere in full stealth mode. His muscles ached from the crouch position he'd been compressed into for the last 10 hours. Even now that he'd finally made some headway into cataloging and arranging the components into distinct piles, the starboard midsection hold was still badly cramped. He was beginning to worry about the assembly process, which was going to require a decent volume to work in, not that he was anywhere close to starting that yet. When Melanie's Redemption passed through the ionosphere, he went back into the cabin and took a quick spore shower. There were still sore patches on his skin where the medical module had repaired the damage he'd received at Florax Villa.
"You should put some cream on those,"
Catriona told him. The beautiful girl's curly hair bobbed about as she tilted her head to one side, registering deep concern. "It doesn't matter," he grunted back.
"It matters to us," Trisha cooed.
Toblum pulled his shabby purple toga suit on, somehow strangely concerned about his dignity in front of the two girls. Having them see him naked was oddly disquieting. Back at the Arevalo apartment, they never did. The daily routines were all perfectly established. He was comfortable with those, but here in the starship's cabin there was little privacy, and the projectors could throw the images just about everywhere. "Thank you," he said, hoping it would shut them up. He didn't want to load in program restrictions, not now he'd constructed their personalities so perfectly. "I'm all right." The last seam on the suit fastened up, and he straightened himself without wincing.
"What are you going to ask him?"
Trisha asked as the starship sank down through the clouds. Far below the fuselage, the sensors had already picked out the white circle of the house, set in its rambling grounds, on the edge of a vast prairie of native vegetation. "I just want 5 minutes of his time, that's all. Then this will all be over." Troblum switched the stealth effect off when they were below 500 meters altitude. The starship settled on the big patch of level grass where two capsules were already parked in the shade of tall reddish-brown trees. He walked down the airlock stairs, sniffing the faint alien pollen in the air. Two figures were already hurrying down the spiral stair that was wrapped around the house's central pillar. Although he normally hated the countryside, Troblum had to admit the raised house in this bucolic setting was fabulous. His U-Shadow reported pings being aimed at him by the men walking towards him. He responded courteously enough with his identity certificate, praying they wouldn't send too many queries about him into the Unisphere. The accelerators would be waiting for any giveaway, though even if they confirmed his location, he should be relatively safe from Marius here.
"I'm Dushikul," the first man said. "Can we help you?"
"Is that really your starship?"
the second one asked. He was younger, definitely a first lifer. Everything about him leaked eagerness and an endearing naivety, not just his Gaia Field presence.
"It looks fantastic."
"Thank you."
"Are those wings?"
"Heat radiators."
"Oh."
"Jesseral, enough," the Shiku chided.
"Sorry."
"I'd like to speak to Oscar, please," Troblum said. Their attitude changed immediately. Dushiku chopped off his Gaia Field emissions as his face hardened, while Jesseral pouted and allowed a wave of upset and worry to spill out of his mind.
"Oscar is not here," Dushiku said stiffly.
"Have I said something wrong?"
"No,"
Jesseral said. His handsome face frowned in misery.
"It's just that Oscar isn't very popular around here right now. He left us in a hurry a few days ago. Apparently, we don't mean nearly as much to him as he does to us. That's always good to know, isn't it? Poor old Anja is still crying her eyes out."
Dushiku's arm went round the younger man's shoulder, squeezing in comfort.
"It's okay. He'll be back."
"Who cares?"
Jesseral said with sudden contempt. "Do you know when he'll be back?" Troblum asked.
"No."
Dushiku gave him a sharp look.
"Do you know him?"
"We have a mutual friend. It is rather important I contact him."
"His U-Shadow is blocking our calls," Jesseral said. "But don't let that put you off. You might have better luck."
"I'll try that, thank you."
"Really?"
Dushiku said. "Why didn't you do that originally instead of coming here?" Troblum's social program reported that Dushiku was becoming irate and curious, and he should say something soothing. It didn't say what.
"It's complicated."
"Where's he gone?"
"Ask her,"
Jesseral said with an effusive glower.
"Who?"
"That Paula Mayo character. She was the last of his old friends to turn up here unannounced. I didn't know there were so many of you."
Troblum stood perfectly still, staring at the now wary men.
"That's a big coincidence."
"Very big. Why would Paula visit Oscar? And what is he doing now? Could they be working together? I didn't see him at Florex Villa."
"Do you know her?"
Dushiku asked. "I know of her.
I have to go now. Troblum turned and made for the airlock ramp.
Hey!
Sorry to have bothered you.
What the hell did you want from him?
Nothing. Nothing at all.
Who in Ozzy's universe are you people?
With the ramp under his feet, Troblum felt a lot safer. He was already ordering the smart core to power up the drive.
Give him back to us, Jessarel yelled. I want Oscar back. I want my Oscar, you bastard.
The airlock closed. Melanie's redemption lifted immediately, accelerating hard, only just keeping subsonic. Troblum knew that was ridiculous. Oscar's lovers didn't present the remotest threat, yet he wanted to get away from them fast. The stealth effect shrouded the fuselage in a refractive smear as they reached the cloud level. Troblum checked, but there were no sensors probing the sky, hunting for him.
Well, they were terrifying, Tricia said contemptuously. She and Catriona were snuggled up together on the cabin's long couch.
Worse than the cat.
You were lucky to get out of there alive.
Shut up, Troblum snapped.
Both girls pouted, then turned to each other, pawing and stroking like kittens. Troblum ignored them and slumped into a big chair. He was still shocked by the revelation. Paula Mayo had visited Oscar. It was the last thing he'd expected. He let out a small grunt of admiration. That was it. Of course, those two working together would be the last thing anyone would expect. So what's he doing for her? The starship reached 400 kilometers altitude. Troblum told it to go FTL and fly 10 light-years clear from Oricum. Oscar's Unisphere code hung in his storage cluster. Immensely tempting. But since Sholapur, he simply didn't trust the Unisphere. Knowing Oscar and Paula were in contact surely gave him some kind of advantage. He just couldn't think what. Catriona raised her head and gave him an affectionate look.
So, where are we going?
Nowhere, he said, coming to a decision. I'm going to assemble the Ultra Drive. After that, I'll do what I can to warn Paula and ANA. At least if it all goes wrong, then, I can run. Paula hadn't visited Paris for decades. The city had reduced considerably since its heyday of the first Commonwealth era. ANA had been as ruthless here as it had everywhere on Earth, pruning away buildings it considered irrelevant. Residual national nostalgia didn't carry much weight in its hard-nosed analysis. However, the truly historic remained. The Eiffel Tower, of course, Arc de Triomphe, Notre Dame, the Palais de la Concorde, most of the original buildings along the Seine. She teleported in from Sky Pier Station above Bordeaux, materializing outside the ancient five-story building where she'd spent so many centuries working, before the days of ANA and higher culture. Beside the door, the original brass sign still gleamed against the dull stonework. Inter-Solar Commonwealth, Serious Crimes Directorate. Paula gave it a melancholy smile and walked into the marbled entrance hall. So many memories haunted this place. Embedded in the structure, they sprang to life everywhere she looked. Images and sounds stronger than the Gaia field could ever produce, and far more meaningful. All those colleagues she'd worked with over the centuries, the cases they'd solved, the battles against innumerable chiefs and political appointees and lawyers, they all echoed round her, welcoming her back. An ANA droid was waiting for her at the lift door, a human simulacrum with featureless gold-brown skin. It wore a simple blue and green suit uniform identical to all its kind. There were tens of thousands of them in the city, performing the maintenance and support functions which the antique buildings and their priceless contents needed. Stabilizer generators alone couldn't preserve the city's fabric, not when it was still in use by nearly 80,000 humans.
Welcome back, Investigator Mayo, it said as the lift doors opened. The voice was as genderless as the body.
Thank you. Paula put her hand on the security pad, allowing the management system to confirm her DNA. Her U-Shadow then had to go through a further lengthy authorization procedure before the lift would descend. They passed through at least two force fields on their way down to the vault. There was also an exotic energy scrambler field around the three sublevels, preventing anyone from teleporting in or opening a wormhole inside. The lift opened into a long hall.
It reminded Paula of the ANA reception facilities, where thousands of recently downloaded bodies waited to see if their minds would adapt to the expansion and freedom inside ANA itself. Only here, instead of the glowing violet spheres, the floor supported long rows of dark sarcophagi.
"This way," the ANA droid said, and gestured politely. Paula accompanied it, their footsteps echoing round the vault.
"How many are stored here?" she asked.
"We currently provide suspension for 1,843 people."
She wondered how many she was responsible for entombing down here. "A good percentage, I'll guess."
"Most still have several hundred years to serve on their sentence," the ANA droid said. "Some exceptional cases will remain down here a great deal longer. A few are even scheduled to remain for longer than the city has already existed."
"Yes," Paula said as they stopped beside one of the bulky suspension cases. "And this is one of them."
"I'd like to see her, please." "You may use a field scan. It will not interfere with the suspension systems. They are quite robust."
"Open it."
"As you wish."
The suspension case's malmetal lid flowed apart. Paula looked down at the body inside. The cat lay there, her body webbed with the silver threads used to provide long-term suspension, ensuring her cells remained intact throughout the sluggish centuries, as she lay poised on the cusp between life and death.
"All hail Schrödinger," Paula muttered.
Her field scan swept through the cat, confirming the small scars and burn patches that she'd acquired in the last ferocious firefight which resulted in her capture. The hospital had healed her for the trial. At the time, several senior members of the directorate, and indeed the president's office itself, had questioned why Paula had allowed her to survive. Political types to whom the rule of law was an irksome guideline to be bent or broken with impunity at every convenience. Paula nodded in satisfaction. This was definitely her old adversary. The original one, at least. Not that originality stood for much anymore.
"How many people have visited her?"
The ANA droid wasn't designed for surprise, but it somehow managed to convey that impression.
"Your inspection, 380 years ago, is the only one, Investigator."
"Thank you," she told the ANA droid.
That was the time when a political group on Far Away had boasted that they'd managed to extract their idol from purgatory. They hadn't, of course. It was just a bid to gain more influence. The lid flowed back into place, sealing the cat back into a darkness that was due to last for another 4,000 years.